This episode is brought to you by Mise-en-Box, bringing restaurant-prepared meal kits to your door. Learn more at mise-en-box.co. That's MISEN box.co.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Eat Your Heartland Out. I'm your host, Capri Cafaro. On today's show, we are exploring how Indigenous people are decolonizing diets across the Midwest. Food sovereignty is often mentioned as a movement contributing to these efforts. Food sovereignty is defined as the right of peoples to healthy and culturally appropriate food produced through ecologically sound and sustainable methods, and their right to define their own food and agricultural systems. These principles seem so basic and intuitive, one may assume that all communities benefit from this kind of food system. But as we will hear from our guest today, that is far from the truth, particularly in some communities. We will hear from Elena Terry of the Ho-Chunk Nation, who tells us why she founded Wild Berries, that's B-E-A-R-I-E-S, an organization that educates Indigenous youth about the community's traditional foodways to both preserve culture and empower the next generation. But first, we welcome Daniel Grooms, business manager of the Red Cliff Fish Company, a business run by and for the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa in Wisconsin. Daniel, thank you for joining the program. We're happy to have you on from Wisconsin and talking about your business as the business manager of the Red Cliff Fish Company there. Introduce us to what you do on a daily basis at the fish company there.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me. Here I am the business manager here. So my main job is to kind of provide an outlet for the fish that we are purchasing and processing. So I meet with restaurants, different programs that provide fish products to other reservations, and then mainly handling kind of our financial invoicing, our bills and things like that, and our QuickBooks. So that's my main job. But lately I've been all on the processing floor, also kind of like learning how everything works, the whole process from taking the fish in to basically the product that in turn that I sell. So I get to get hands-on training, and you know, it definitely helps me be more proactive and more detailed in my sales pitch.
We can start to see a day sort of in your shoes day to day doing this job, but it's always good to get a little context. And you are Lake Superior Chippewa, and part of the, I guess, motivation behind establishing the Red Cliff Fish Company was to help engage and feed your fellow at Lake Superior Chippewa. Is that right?
That is correct. Yep.
Tell me about that. Tell me about what inspired starting this business.
Sure. Yeah. Well, in this area in particular, we're fortunate enough to be right on one of the biggest lakes in the world, on Lake Superior here. And the natives in this community, you know, hunting and gathering is kind of our biggest, you know, form of tradition and some of our heritage and culture. And for a while there, we were kind of restricted to inland rivers and lakes, but Red Cliff being a tribe that's mainly coastline, mm-hmm. you know, we have the lake. You know, we don't really have a lot of inland areas where we can catch fish. So the whole process kind of started. We had people in the area who wanted to fish, commercial fishermen in particular. There are tribal members. And for them to be able to go out and harvest something that our people here have been doing for forever, you know, it was kind of a fight for that right. So the whole process kind of started with, yes, definitely that. It was also to, you know, take care of our fishermen. Mm-hmm. The other fishing companies in the area, there was definitely competition and some unfair treatment. So we really wanted to make sure that they had a place where, one, they could bring their fish and get a fair wage, but as well, again, be able to fish these local waters and have a place to dock as well. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the main focus in the beginning of the whole project. And then it quickly turned into the potential this place has, being able to provide healthier alternatives to our tribe itself, mainly with the younger generation to kind of introduce them to a healthier eating lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And then also to provide a healthier alternative as well as a fresh wild-caught Lake Superior product.
And what are those fish that you catch?
Predominantly, we do whitefish, Lake Superior whitefish, and lake trout are kind of our big ones for the summer. Towards the end, and depending on the season, we'll have walleye, herring. We do get some burbot here and there. And then we also get chubs, I believe Cisco and some bloater chubs. So mm-hmm. a little bit smaller fish, similar to a herring, but those are kind of our main fish that we collect here.
So in talking to other individuals in the Native American and Indigenous communities, I've discussed the issue of food sovereignty relatively often. And I'm curious to know sort of your view on you know, Red Cliff's role potentially in food sovereignty for the Lake Superior Chippewa community and in the other communities that you serve, either with, you know, providing them with fish products or with helping provide that access point to being able to fish the waters and earn a fair wage, as you said.
Yeah, so definitely. With the food sovereignty, again, the big thing was there to allow for an opportunity for the fishermen in the area, which is kind of our big step. But then again, so that helps out a lot of, we have about 15 or more Red Cliff licensed commercial fishermen. Mm. And so they all have an opportunity, so that supports themselves and a lot of the community members. Most boats have a pretty good sized crew, depending especially the time of year. And then also it helps support their families, which is, it's a great kind of economic little boost for our small tribe here. But when it comes to, you know, food in itself with the fish products that we do offer, like I said, you know, we are providing a healthier alternative, which is kind of our huge thing there, but also the programs we are now entering for tribes that are within the area, Wisconsin, Michigan, and even some, you know, potential in Minnesota that don't have the option for mm-hmm. fish of this, you know, quality or this type of fish. Now we're providing that to them as well.
Right.
And so in turn, you know, we're working with organizations for food boxes. So we're collecting
wow.
food from other tribes that maybe they harvest and are able to do. And we're kind of filling in the gaps with fish.
Can you describe to me what a food box may look like, what it might entail, or and who it would go to?
Yeah. So food boxes, primarily the programs that we're entered in now, are predominantly for the elderly in the community. We're usually age 55 and up. Mm-hmm. So within each box that we are participating in, they will get about a pound and a half or a little bit more of fish, frozen fish fillets from us. But other tribes will donate, you know, produce, they'll usually, you know, lettuce, carrots, tomatoes. We even have elk, venison.
Wow.
That's been, you know, offered up in this program. So mainly those types of things, and then also, you know, recipes to try out for cooking. Wild rice is another big one.
Oh, yes. Wild rice is such an important component. I know, particularly in places like Minnesota.
Yes.
Just such an important component of the diet.
Yeah, absolutely. And then for us here, it's not that we don't have it, but again, with the lake being here, you know, you don't have a lot of wild rice. You don't have any wild rice growing on the lake.
Right.
Lake Superior, I should say. So we definitely are working, you know, in a partnership to really kind of, you know, provide, you know, again, healthier alternatives to our elders. And then also, again, yeah, back to the community is kind of our big step.
That's huge. And you know, I'm glad that you have mentioned, you know, a number of times this idea of healthy alternatives. And maybe for those that might not be as aware of some of the challenges that exist in on reservations and in Native American communities with nutritional access, maybe you can provide some insight into, you know, why it's so important to have those healthy alternatives available.
Well, I think, you know, just in general, you know, growing up here in the reservation, you know, folks get used to, you know, basically what's convenient, what's fast and easier to prepare. You know, people do work, you know, very hard, just like anywhere. And again, sometimes making dinner Except even myself, sometimes it gets tough to make dinner. But to have that opportunity, it's not just providing the healthy product, but we do workshops and things to show folks the breaking down of the fish, what parts can be used for, what type of cooking, how to prepare it in itself, and then also some of the nutritional facts and how it can benefit you in the long run.
How do you get that message out there? I mean, how do you do those trainings? I mean, to be able to get that message to, the community at large so they know. I know in some communities, for example, not necessarily Indigenous communities, but just, in my experience, in my role when I was training as a social worker, and we would do a lot with like diabetes education stuff, trying to help folks manage their diabetes. And so we would, partner up with folks to do diabetes education, and we would have these farmers market boxes and help people sort of connect the dots between how to prepare these different ingredients they may not be familiar with, how to, prepare them, and then, why it's valuable to managing their diabetes. And that, when you're telling me this, is kind of what I'm thinking in my head.
No, yeah, absolutely. I said mainly for us, we're providing our product, we have all our information. For us in particular, we've been approached for coming out to these camps, these language programs. I know we have one coming up at like a wolf camp for the youth.
Oh, wow.
Those we are actually asked to do a presentation based on, types of fish that we carry, benefits to, overall. And then we do kind of like a filleting type of demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
So usually our operations manager will usually take that task on, and he'll get out there and he'll even cook it. So a lot of even the community members that get our fish that are running these camps, even though we're not there, are able to, again, pass that along as well. So it's kind of the community in itself working together to get that information out there and the benefits. I mean, we're doing a good amount of fish for those programs and communities that it's their main meat that they're doing. So it's very abundant.
One of the things I wanted to bring up, before I forget about it, because it's very important, but I remember in looking at the information that was available on the website, and there was a lot of references and discussion about basically kind of being stewards of the water and the approach to fishing and, the approach to, respecting the land and that being part of, the traditions of Indigenous peoples and the Lake Superior Chippewa. I'd like to hear more about how those traditions have, informed or impacted the way that you fish, and maybe even the way that you end up preparing, whether it's filleting or cooking, the bounty that you do get.
Yeah. So, in the stewardship with our fishermen, and it's been great to be able to meet them. I've been here the last 2.5 months or so. It's been great to kind of, get to know them in general, but kind of learn their process, learn the industry. A lot of them, with Red Cliff and the council, as well as our other agencies within here. The fishermen work very well with not overfishing. They usually run about a certain yardage for netting they can do kind of in a season, or they're allotted a certain amount of tags for trout. Basically, this is kind of just making sure that, we're balancing things out. We don't want to, run the fish out of the water, basically. And so that's kind of one of our safety measure in itself. But working with the fishery here is also kind of part of their department. And they, what they're doing is they're raising fish that can be, released back into lake to increase the numbers. So it's kind of like balancing it out so that way, we always have a supply.
Sure.
So that's, that's pretty huge there. And in so far, and even just with my little knowledge coming into this, it has been great being able to see that, the working relationship between kind of, a personal business, like a commercial fisherman, and an entire community.
How do you see Red Cliff Fish and its mission evolving to help, serve and empower the Lake Superior Chippewa and neighboring reservations?
Yeah, well, the big thing is even just with, passing down kind of like a traditional aspect, this is kind of one of, something our people have been doing here for forever. And it's, you know, not just, again, a lot of the fishermen are getting older, but they're passing that knowledge down to the next generation and the importance of what they're doing and how it provides not only for their families, a financial standpoint, but how the work that they're doing can benefit a group of people. And even with us here, we're working with a lot of youth, just passing down. Again, yes, we're processing. It's a slightly different part of it, but it is an essential part. And it's, why we're breaking down what components can be used of the fish and how to kind of prepare it for the masses. So it's a little bit different for us, but we're still able to pass down that knowledge as well. So I think in the long run with, the younger generation slowly taking over, they see the kind of the importance of the whole process. And again, how it can really benefit the people here, their families, but then in turn to all of our customers. Mm-hmm. Visiting and, restaurants, wholesale, that type of deal.
Yeah. I mean, you have to play, it's every single aspect. Every single piece of the puzzle is incredibly important. And before I let you go, I have to ask you one more question, which is a little bit off the wall, but this is a food show. Mm-hmm. But it's my understanding that you are not only Lake Superior Chippewa, but your mom has a Hispanic heritage. Is that right?
That is absolutely correct.
So because it's a food show, I have to ask, did you grow up with any kind of unique food traditions that brought those two cultural food traditions together in a unique way that you remember or that you still do today?
Well, combining them, yeah, I would say so. Dinner-wise, we may have some type of components from each type of, background. My mom mainly did a good amount of the cooking. My dad's more of, hey, if I'm cooking, I'll make some pizza kind of thing. But
right.
Yeah, the typical. No, growing up, my mom was very involved with us, my younger brother and I, in preparing mainly, Mexican cuisine, enchiladas, Spanish rice, and, homemade tortillas, which are phenomenal.
Corn tortillas?
Definitely corn tortillas as well. So, I've also been part of preparing that for the family. So we've kind of incorporated, a little bit of there, some wild rice, mixed in to kind of, change up the recipe a little. Mm-hmm. And we do have those traditions. I know every winter, my mom and I usually make, I think she calls it pan de polvo. It's a kind of a Spanish sugar cookie.
Mm.
And it's just a recipe that she was passed on from her mom and her mom before that. So it's kind of a tradition. And since she had no girls, I'm kind of taking over that. And that's something that's now passed down to me. So, when my wife and I decided to start a family, it's something we can continue to pass along.
I love it. This is what I always have to ask, about when I know that there's, maybe an heirloom recipe out there or a family tradition that's interesting. I got to ask about it because recipes tell stories and they preserve history. So while that was not the purpose of this conversation, I'm glad that I learned about it. And I know that our listeners, I'm sure, are as well, because, to me at least, telling the story of the Midwest, and that's what this show is all about, is showing that, rich diversity of culture, of heritage, of land, of resources, and, first and foremost, our building blocks of our story in this region and this whole continent starts with our Native American and Indigenous neighbors. So I'm always excited to do my best to help others tell that story. So, Daniel, thank you very much for joining us today. It really was a pleasure, and maybe we'll have you on again sometime.
Absolutely. Again, thanks so much for the opportunity and taking the time and to speak with me. So again, thanks so much, and happy to help.
Absolutely. We have great respect for what you're doing out there in Wisconsin. Thanks again.
Thank you.
I'm Capri Cafaro. You're listening to Eat Your Heartland Out. We will be right back after this break with Elena Terry, founder of Wildberries. Mm-hmm.
episode is brought to you by Miesenbox, bringing restaurant-prepared meal kits to your door and enabling anyone to be the hero of their kitchen. You can book fun and lively virtual cooking sessions featuring restaurant chefs who guide the group through the preparation of their home-delivered meal kit. They're always looking for new restaurant partners. If you're a restaurant, a food truck operator, or a catering food brand looking for an additional line of revenue, Miesenbox can help get you into the meal kit space in a matter of days. If you are an eater, recommend your favorite restaurant and Miesenbox will take care of the rest. Learn more at miesenbox.co. That's MISENbox.co.
Welcome back to Eat Your Heartland Out. We're now joined by Elena Terry, a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, executive chef, and founder of Wild Berries. Elena, thank you for joining us.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, I want you to take an opportunity to tell our listeners about the Ho-Chunk tribe.
So the Ho-Chunk Nation is located in Wisconsin. I specifically am in South Central Wisconsin, but we're throughout the entire state, and we are a non-reservation tribe. So we actually have trust lands throughout from northern Wisconsin down to Milwaukee.
And I find this interesting because I was not familiar with the Ho-Chunk Nation prior to our conversation. But it is, as you mentioned, without land, but is related to a tribe that does have land in another part of the country, I guess, originally. But the Ho-Chunk Nation is different because they were the group that would continue to go back to Wisconsin. Is that right?
Yes. So the reservation actually came from a divide that happened within the tribe when we were moved to Nebraska, Winnebago, Nebraska. And so there is part of the tribe originally that stayed down there and they have a reservation. But the Ho-Chunk are the ones that always return back to Wisconsin. And that's why we don't have a reservation here. And now we are recognized as two separate tribes.
I see. So the individuals that identify as being part of the Ho-Chunk tribe live within, you know, the greater communities throughout that region in Wisconsin, right?
Yes. And beyond. We do have tribal members that live throughout
sure,
the country, but
I'm
this
sure.
is our largest populated area is in the state of Wisconsin, yes.
This is the wonderful thing about doing a show like this. You learn something new every day, having conversations with people like yourself. And we try to bring this kind of information and knowledge to our listenership. So obviously we are a show about food. You have a pretty extensive and interesting background when it comes to the indigenous food sovereignty movement, which I think both predates as well as kind of runs in parallel to your work with Wild Berries. So I want to talk first about your work in the Indigenous Food Sovereignty Movement.
Of course. So I am the Native American Food Sovereignty Alliance's Food and Culinary Program Coordinator, which means basically that I run the International Chef Mentorship Program, which has over 120 Indigenous chefs of all skill sets in the program. And it really is about building a stronger community there and sharing education and knowledge and really being a support group. But I also work in partnership with the Intertribal Agriculture Council and the American Indian Foods Program in promoting Indigenous production and really supporting economically our Indigenous producers. Being in the position of a chef and being able to have selection and choices and what we choose to use as product, we always try and go with our Indigenous suppliers initially. So I do a lot of collaboration with those programs, as well as in the Madison area, I do a lot with the Mobile Farmers Market and with growing out certain ingredients. So that's one of the amazing things that I get to do is kind of work with farms and growers and people in agriculture to get our ingredients grown on a better scale.
Well, speaking of growing ingredients, you introduced me to a term
Seed to Kitchen. Now, most of us hear about farm to table, but Seed to Kitchen is a little bit more granular, literally and figuratively. What does that mean to you, Seed to Kitchen? And why is that relevant to the Indigenous food sovereignty movement?
Well, Seed to Kitchen is the only way we really can exist and maintain the integrity of our ingredients. So every year I, you know, meticulously harvest the seeds from the product that gets given to us and really take care of those seeds as a seed saver. And it's a necessary part of my job because the seeds that we work with are ancestral seeds, and they are hundreds of years old, and they've been grown by tribes and maintain their integrity over centuries. So we really have to do our part in making sure that those seeds that grow out our very specific product are grown in an environment where they will thrive, where they won't be cross-pollinated, and that their seed will have enough for the next year's grow. So Seed to Kitchen is the only way that we really can exist and have existed for centuries in being able to maintain our ingredients in the levels that they do. And they really do have some incredible characteristics that some cultivated varieties of their species don't. So we want to make sure that that continues on in a responsible and a sustainable way.
Can you give me some examples of some of those unique characteristics?
Some of the seeds may have, like the corn might have a higher protein content than others, or if you dry it in particular ways, even in processing. I mean, it's a very scientific method to process corn and nixtamalization, but there are ways that you can draw out some of those more higher nutritious properties, even as far as vitamin content when you nixtamalize the corn.
Wow. Outside of corn, are there other seed varieties that you focus on or that you, you know, have more of as you are going through as a, I think you called yourself a seed saver or a seed keeper as you catalog these seeds?
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, I actually am known for my love of squash.
I love me some squash. I may have to come in check out your wares there.
It's one of my favorites because it can be sweet or savory. It can reconstitute well, and it's so high in vitamins. So I save a lot of my squash seeds to make sure that I will have those grown out for me in the way that I want them. So there's certain varieties that I prefer to cook with and to preserve for the long term. So I definitely am a seed saver for squash. And the three sisters, really, the corn, bean, and squash that grow perfectly together and really have all these stories of connecting to our ancestors and the reason that we were cultivators. I love growing out all of those. And so I keep the beans, the squash, and the corn seeds always. But there are some others, including some wild plants that we just kind of spread out when we get them or find them in the seed stage to make sure that they'll be able to thrive as well.
Well, you mentioned, you know, connection to your heritage to and connection to the land. And I have a sense that that was one of the reasons why you founded Wild Berries. What made you start Wild Berries? Where was the motivation? And how did this come to be?
So Wild Berries really came, it manifested itself, and I've been lucky enough to be along for the ride. It really is a way that our mission is to reintroduce people to the community or bring them back to the community who have suffered a disconnect through alcohol and other drug abuse issues or emotional trauma, which I think is universal enough that everybody can relate to it in some way.
Sure.
But it really kind of opens the door to get people who might have felt that disconnection from our community for whatever reason back into the kitchen, into our community in a way where they can be proud of what we produce in a way that will be non-judgmental. And as long as you're willing to put in the work, you can participate really when it comes to mentorship and what Wild Berries hopes to do with just promoting self-esteem and community around food and food sovereignty. It's to have people be proud again, to relate and to have that connection. And what better way to do that than through sharing a meal, through preparing a meal, or even through supporting those who find a passion in that. So we have Wild Berries now that have kind of broken down off into garden berries, and they have become seed savers in their own sense and have become cultivators and are growing. And that's where they feel the connection, but they are still part of the Wild Berries team. So it's really is become a holistic approach to food sovereignty in our communities and just building a stronger community around those incredible foods that we have.
Planting a seed literally and figuratively. I know that there are a number of different type of programs that you have under this umbrella that you just kind of described in these general but powerful terms. You mentioned mentorship. I know that, you know, food preparation, catering, and those type of things are also involved. What kind of specific programs does Wild Berries lead? Walk us through maybe a traditional day of someone that might be in a mentorship program, at the farmer's market or doing food preparation and that sort of thing.
So Wild Berries does do catering. And one of the things that we focus on is community education and really recognizing that we're part of this larger, beautiful community. And as long as things are done responsibly and knowledge is shared in a good way with people who will respect that knowledge, that's what we really try to do. And it's not just incorporating our participants in the Indigenous community or the Ho-Chunk community, but in our greater communities. And so we have been able to take some of the Wild Berries off and really represent what it is we're working towards at places like the Overture Center in Madison in support of gallery openings. We have done Taste of Madison several years in a row. We also have done Femstival in Madison, which was the first ever last year, and it was a wonderful thing to participate in and just to support our greater community. And we even have gone and done the homegrown stand at Farm Aid in support of agriculture and really trying to make sure that we take a strong stance behind those who provide our food.
Wow.
So yeah, some of it is kitchen time. Some of it is community outreach time that we spend. And a lot more of it is conversation and really just being able to break down those barriers that sometimes we put up ourselves. And the reason I wanted to do Wild Berries is because I've felt it at times. And there have been times when I've thought, you know, oh, how do I get back from this? And the wonderful way to do it is through sharing meals and really taking pride in that preparation. And if your role was to grow the ingredients or to prepare the ingredients, we all have a place in that food system and getting that meal. And I think that's one of the beautiful things that Wild Berries has to offer is that it is relatable to anybody whose interests might not be specifically in culinary skills, but really in being a part of something bigger.
One thing that really struck me, again, from our initial conversation is about the role that feelings and emotion have in food preparation. And you shared with me some really interesting insights from your perspective that I'd like you to share with our listeners. Tell us how you feel about feelings and emotions and how they impact the food preparation.
One of our rules, not just with Wild Berries, but just culturally, is that you're not supposed to be in the kitchen if you don't have a good mindset, if you have those bad feelings. That goes into your food. And so my kitchen definitely is not the kitchen where you see a chef yelling around. It's got order in it for sure because I am a chef and I need that. But it also is a requirement that you do come in the proper frame of mind and that you are open and that you have those wonderful feelings because food is medicine and there's so much more to it than just eating mindlessly. It's the healing that happens in preparation and cultivation and in consumption. And when you want to feed people that medicine and really nourish their bodies, you want to do it in a good way. Like the intentions and the feelings that you have definitely come out in your food. And so I think that it's an aspect that isn't highly talked about so much, but it's almost hard to ignore when you are cooking with food, like ingredients that you know came from a grandfather and his grandsons that went ricing, or you know that, you know, this squash was grown and talked to and, you know, it, when it was weeded, there was music playing, those kinds of things. are also part of bringing it to the table. So it's honoring sure. all of that intention that went into getting that meal. And as a chef, your responsibility is like to really represent those ingredients in the way that they are going to shine and be appreciated in every bite. And I think that the key ingredient is really love and good intention.
That's just what a beautiful sentiment. You know, I wish that everyone had this kind of approach to food and to community. And I certainly will take more of a mindful approach in my own kitchen when thinking about preparation and that intention of thinking about, you know, our where food comes from, the supply chain. Not all of us have that, you know, deep connection to the land, but we also need to honor, you know, where our food does come from and to take that time and to have that space and definitely a lesson that we can all apply in our daily lives. It's just been a pleasure to speak with you, Elena, and you know, hear about your mission and Wild Berries. So thank you for sharing your story with our audience. Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.